Well, despite spending more money per person on education than comparable countries, Australia is still grappling with a literacy crisis. Almost half of adults, 44%, can't read the instructions on a medicine bottle when their child is ill, fill out a form, or read a label on a food package. For Indigenous Australians in remote areas, the figure for illiteracy can be as high as 70%. Niyimba man Jack Beetson has dedicated his life to tackling adult literacy, first as a teacher and then co-founding the Literacy for Life Foundation, which trains Indigenous people to bring literacy to their own communities and transform lives. I'm very pleased to say that Jack is my guest this morning on Changing Australia. Jack, welcome and good morning.
Good morning, Sally. Thank you.
Can we go way back here, Jack? Your own path to education wasn't an easy one. Despite being ducks of primary school at Ningen in New South Wales, you left high school at the age of 13. What happened for you, Jack?
Oh, I think a lot of things happened, but I think back then there was no recourse for Aboriginal people if their children were removed from school. It was entirely up to the PNC and the principal of the day.
What sort of effect do you think that had on your early years, Jack?
Probably, you know, if I was looking at myself back then, it probably affected me a lot because I was removed from school and I went and worked in the cotton fields and the shearing sheds. But if I look back now, with a view of the history that followed, it's probably one of the best things that ever happened, to be honest.
Yeah, sometimes things work in mysterious ways. You eventually returned to education as a young adult, attending Tranby Aboriginal College in Sydney, and became one of the first Indigenous Australians to complete a university degree in adult education. You ended up staying on at Tranby. At what point in that journey did you realise that education would become something of a life mission for you, Jack?
Oh, I think just because I went to Tranby as a student, I got so much out of that I wanted to give back what I'd gotten. And honestly, over all the years I was at Tranby, which was about 19 or 20 years, every year I was there I felt more indebted. So I wasn't really working my way out of debt at all. And then finally, I think about 2004, I resigned from Tranby and just took a break for a while and then came back and did a few other things but found my way back to literacy.
What sort of techniques were being used at Tranby? What did you see that really worked?
I just think that there's a whole thing around cultural safety. You felt safe because you're with all your own mob. I think the fact that you could contribute to the curriculum, and it wasn't just about learning in an academic sense. It also, you felt like you were part of a much bigger movement, you know, like Bishop Tutu came to Tranby. We were part of the group that met Nelson Mandela when he came here. We were the head office of the Committee to Defend Black Rights. So not only was there an academic growth, there was also a political growth in that as well.
What challenges are teaching an adult who's struggling with literacy? What sort of challenges are there, not only in that process of learning to read and write? Is there an issue of confidence as well? Have people kind of lost a bit of confidence in their ability to get through with it?
Absolutely, and there's a fear. I mean, they've come through an education system that absolutely failed them as Aboriginal people, and they're afraid to come back. And I feel so privileged when I go to a community and they want to work with the foundation that they trust us enough to be able to deliver on what others couldn't for so many years.
It sounds like it's a real point of vulnerability for some people, Jack. It's the thing they sort of fear the most, and there's a lot of really strong feelings there given what's happened in the early days for a lot of people.
Yeah, there sure is. I mean, how vulnerable can you be, you know? Most of these people can't read the dosage on a medicine bottle. That's extremely vulnerable when you're living in households that accommodate, you know, people that are suffering from the most traumatic illnesses and chronic diseases in the country. And you have people that can't read and write administering their medications, not only to elderly people, but to young people and babies and themselves.
Mm. What did some people tell you maybe later on about the kind of tricks they were using to hide their illiteracy, especially if they're out in the workforce and sometimes people would, on the quiet, get someone else to have a look at things for them, maybe a family member? What were people telling you, Jack?
Well, yeah, they use all kinds of tricks. I knew people that I never knew that couldn't read and write because they'd just say, oh, look, I left my glasses at home or, you know, oh, my eyes are really sore this morning. They'd pull all sorts of tricks to hide that. Purely and simply because they were bearing a shame that they shouldn't have been. The people who should feel ashamed that we have such a high rate of low English literacy in Australia are the people that can read and write, not those that can't, because we're the ones that are leaving them behind.
What are some of the first things that you see if you're teaching someone or teaching them again, if they've had bad experiences previously, to read and write? When that first bit of progress comes, what do you see in those students, Jack?
We were talking about this at a staff retreat last week in Queensland and that whole thing of when somebody actually gets it, when they write that first sentence and get it, it's like a flashlight comes on. I can't claim the credit for teaching them to do that because we train local people that can read and write to teach those that can't.
You're listening to Changing Australia on Radio National Breakfast. My guest this morning is Professor Jack Beetson, who's been involved in some fantastic efforts to improve literacy, particularly in remote communities. Jack, in 2013, you co-founded the Literacy for Life Foundation along with your colleagues Pat Anderson and Donna Archie and others. How does it work? What's the idea that's really underpinning it all?
I think what came out of our retreat was the thing that underpins everything, and that's that people care, and that's what's required to achieve the results we achieve is that people care.
Why do you think that's so important?
Because the people on the other side of that know they care, and that's why it's really important when you're in community where you're training local mob to do the work, to actually do the teaching in the classroom. They know they care about them because they're family. They're not embarrassed by being in there because they're family. Family already know where their literacy course is at the moment, you know, where their journey is in literacy. So all of that is the thing that makes a difference. But it's not just about Aboriginal mob caring. It's about all the non-Aboriginal mob that work with us. They care as much as we do that there's a whole bunch of people that can't read and write English literacy. And that's a real problem. And in our communities, I heard you say in the introduction that, you know, in some communities it's 70% of people have low English literacy. In some communities, up to 90%.
How does the training work? How do you structure it when you go into a community to identify who wants and needs some help and who may be able to provide that help, Jack?
Yeah, we train local people, again, that can read and write. To do a household survey. So we get them to go around into their section of the community or within their factional or family group of the community that they live in. I'll talk about Brewarrina. In Brewarrina, there's five Aboriginal communities. There's the four little communities on the outskirts of the town, and then there's the people that live in the town. So we don't try and break down those factions. We train two people within each of those sections of the community to do a household survey. And during that household survey, one of the questions we ask is, you know, do you think this is a good idea for your community? So people are actually getting a choice about whether we come or not right at the very beginning. But what that also does is transfer ownership to the community over the whole process. So we establish what we call a governance group, but that's a group of people that advise us all the way through the work that we do and, in fact, suggest the people we might get to do the household survey and so on. So it's really about giving community ownership. And we've cried out for years that at the end of the day, Aboriginal people need to own the process for the process to work and be a sustainable proposition.
What happens after that household survey and that governance structure is set up? What happens then?
Well, once that's done, we train some of those household survey workers to be the facilitators in the classroom. And the lessons are on a DVD, so it's some actors on DVD that are acting and out of class, and we work with that. And there's little sort of, you know, I guess exercises that go through it. It's all about positive messaging and those sorts of things. So,
Jack, I know that in addition to your work in literacy, you've also taken a very strong interest in Indigenous rights, and you're currently a director of Just Reinvest New South Wales. How connected are literacy and justice issues?
Oh, very connected. If you go back to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, the report found that 92% of Aboriginal people that were incarcerated had very low English literacy levels. Now, the flip side of that is enormous, and we've demonstrated that through our work and through our research. And the numbers were crunched by the University of New South Wales, so there was a large degree of independence in the outcome. But what we found was that in the community, in eight communities where people had participated in the work and the participants themselves, we did data linkage research, and what we found was that there was a 65% reduction in serious crime, there was an 80% reduction in driving offences, and there's a 100% reduction in theft. Now, if that doesn't tell you something, what does?
What have you learnt from all this? There's been a lot of teaching, but I'm guessing you've probably learnt more than you've given out, I imagine, Jack.
Oh, always. Look, what I've learnt is this is the greatest thing I've ever been involved in my life, and it's the most emotional thing that I've ever been involved in my entire life. It's just such a great thing to be part of.
What's the strongest emotion with all of this, do you think?
Oh, just at every graduation you go to, everybody's crying, and I've done that a few times myself, just because people know the journey these people have been on. You know, when you've got people that in some cases only know, you know, four or five letters of the alphabet, and in 11 weeks they're writing a sentence and reading that out publicly, that's a very emotional journey for everybody concerned.
It's such vital work, and the approach that you're using is creating great connection with these communities. Jack Beetson, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Sally. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Professor Jack Beetson, co-founder of Literacy for Life Foundation.